Hi everyone, and welcome to The Great Integral Awakening. My name is Claire Zammit, and in addition to being one of the presenters in the series, I'm also on the board of Integral Enlightenment, the organization producing this event. It's great to have you with us for part 7 in our series featuring Craig Hamilton on Awakening to the Call of the Cosmos. And I'd like to extend a special welcome to everyone who's joining us for the first time this morning. We now have nearly 11,000 people participating, and it's exciting to feel the interest growing every day. It's also exciting to see the thriving community starting to build on our Facebook group. We now have over 2,000 participants in the Facebook group with over 35 active discussion forums. So if you're looking for a community of like-minded friends and want to continue the conversation online, you can check it out. I'm sure you'll find people discussing something you're interested in. There's a link in the email we sent you this morning, or you can just search on Facebook for The Great Integral Awakening. We also want to thank our co-hosts at Integral Life and all 8 of our co-sponsors for their support. Our presenter today is Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton, who is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series. So far, Craig has been a gracious host to all of our presenters, and now it's his turn to share with us his visionary approach to spiritual life he calls Integral Enlightenment. The way it's going to work is this. Craig will talk for about an hour and then we'll open it up for questions. Craig Hamilton is a contemporary mystic and pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. In his inspired writings, talks, and teachings, he calls us to awaken beyond the confines of the separate ego and dedicate our lives to further the evolution of consciousness itself. Craig began his spiritual journey in the ashrams and monasteries of the East, but it was his liberating encounter with an authentic Western teaching of enlightenment that provided the catalyst and container for his own transformation. For 13 years, he lived and worked in a dynamic living laboratory of evolution under the guidance of Enlightened Next founder and spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen, ultimately playing a key role in the leadership of this thriving international spiritual community. He has served for years as an inspirational and guiding force in the spiritual lives of practitioners around the world. In his current work, Craig integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. Through his writings and teachings, he is helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary mysticism, an integral enlightenment, which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. He outlines the principles and practices of this new evolutionary spiritual path in his forthcoming books, The Future of God and Integral Enlightenment. Craig is a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute and a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. A master of the art of spiritual dialogue, his celebrated conversations with other luminaries are regularly heard by New Dimensions Radio's 7 million listeners and form the basis of this 14-part webinar series, The Great Integral Awakening, Pioneering a New Spiritual Path. A frequent contributor to Shift magazine and co-author of ION's 2008 Shift Report, he is also co-writer and story editor of the forthcoming documentary film, The Shift. Craig lives and teaches in Berkeley, California, where he offers instruction and guidance in meditation and other aspects of evolutionary spiritual practice. So please join me in welcoming Craig Hamilton.
Thank you very much, Claire. And hello, everyone, and welcome back. And welcome to those of you who are here for the first time. It's really great to be doing this again. It's been a real honor over these last weeks to host so many of my friends and colleagues on the series. And I have to say I'm also really looking forward to this opportunity to share with you some of my own deeper thoughts on these questions and on what we're really talking about here on pioneering a new spiritual path. Specifically, what I really want to go into today is the deepest reason why I created this series in the first place. It's something that, for me, I would call a matter of ultimate significance, something that is really important. And what it is that there's a predicament facing us collectively right now, which is not often discussed, and which I just want to bring forward into the conversation so that it does get discussed and so that we start to look at it for what it is. Now, that predicament goes like this. I think when most of us started out on the spiritual path, when we began seeking spiritually, many of us had a sense that an extraordinary kind of spiritual transformation was possible. It may have come through an initial experience we had or a glimpse of something. And for some of us, it may have come a bit further down the path after we had done some practice and started to have some initial openings or awakenings. But I think that in our deepest kind of spiritual heart of hearts, we've had a sense that there's the potential for a radical realignment at the deepest levels of our being that would not only liberate us from our personal suffering, but that would really infuse our entire lives with a sacred cosmic sense of meaning, purpose, and wholeness. And yet the truth is that although many of us are spending an enormous amount of our life energy engaging in spiritual practice and other efforts to grow spiritually, most of the growth that we've actually experienced is of a relative nature. In other words, it's not that kind of absolute transformative possibility that we glimpsed. You know, we're generally happier, we're more content, we're more centered, maybe we're more aware of our issues, we maybe kind of feel more aware in certain ways, but very few of us are finding the true fruits of the spiritual path, what we long for most deeply. And truthfully, by now, many of us have been meditating, doing workshops and retreats for 20, 30, even 40 years. And although I know we may feel like we've made progress in many areas, there's still a sense that there's somewhere deeper to go. And even if we've had a lot of spiritual experience, I think many of us may even feel like we have an ongoing living connection with spirit. In some sense, I think many of us, when we just look honestly at ourselves, we can see that our egos are still running the show, that we're still not deeply free human beings. And hand in hand with this recognition is the observation that many of us have made that many of our leading spiritual teachers also seem to be in the grips of their egos, that they're, you know, subject to the same human failings as the rest of us. And, you know, we've seen one scandal after another rock the spiritual world over the past few decades, leaving a lot of us scratching our heads trying to make sense of all this. And I would say that the impact of all this on our collective psyche is significant, because we are meaning-making creatures, and we are going to look for patterns and try to interpret what's happening. And the meaning that I feel we've made out of this reality is influencing the cultural climate in some real and significant ways. In many ways, I think it's led to a kind of erosion of our belief in the potential for a truly extraordinary transformation. In ways we're not even aware of, many of us have drawn the conclusion that enlightenment isn't what we thought it was, that it may not be possible to transform in the way that we had originally imagined it was. And I want to make it clear that I'm talking in some ways about something kind of subtle, that it may not be immediately apparent. You know, you might say, well, hey, no, I still believe in enlightenment. I still believe in spirituality. I mean, obviously we all do to some degree, or we wouldn't be doing the practice we're doing. We wouldn't be listening to this series. So I'm not saying everybody's become sort of necessarily deeply cynical about the possibility of transformation. I just think our sense of what that transformation could look like and of what's actually possible has been knocked down several notches by the lack of real results on one hand, by, you know, what I pointed out about spiritual teachers on the other. And I think it might be helpful for me to just illustrate with some examples of what I might call the narrative of non-possibility that's starting to show up in the cultural conversation around spirituality, or at least a sort of narrative of limited possibilities. And the first example I want to point to is what I would call the "we're only human" narrative. Now, this idea has been championed by many popular spiritual teachers. It's something that's got a lot of currency in the conversation these days. And the idea is that enlightenment is not really all it's been cracked up to be, and that the ideal that we could radically transform our humanity is kind of a pipe dream that really is just a temptation to split off from certain aspects of our flawed humanity and aim for a kind of perfection that doesn't actually exist. And if you want to, some examples you might be familiar with, we often hear this idea, you know, hey, we're only human. We all have a lot of human flaws or imperfections, and rather than engaging in some futile effort to change this, we just need to accept it and stop trying to override it with our spiritual ideals. Or you may have heard people say, we all have a spiritual side and we have a human side, and we need to stop denying our human side and just accept it. There's even a notion out there of what spiritual maturity is, which is when we stop trying to be something we're not and just embrace ourselves as we are with all of our imperfections and foibles. Now, I'm sure some of that's familiar to you. And the assumption inherent in this is that no matter how enlightened we become, we're still going to have our stuff to deal with. And one derivation of this is the popular notion borrowed from pop psychology that we're all doing the best we can, which is in its essence actually the opposite of what a sort of mystical or Dharma-based view of the human condition would be, which is that none of us are really doing the best we can and we need to all do a lot better. The second kind of major narrative that I think is out there right now around this is this idea of what I would call it the here and now narrative. And the basic assertion here is that spirituality in the end is just about accepting and embracing the present moment. For instance, we hear that enlightenment's not about changing anything, but is really just about accepting and loving what is as it is, including the world and all its limitations. Or that it's just about being in the now or embracing the present moment. Or even, some would say, we should do away with words like enlightenment because they make us feel like there's somewhere to go, like we need to get somewhere rather than just accept things as they are. And since I'm here talking about integral ideas, and I know there are a lot of people listening who are interested in integral theory, one idea within the world of integral theory that's gained a lot of momentum and currency around this is this idea of lines of development has been used by many theorists to reduce spirituality to a single developmental line, which is divorced from our moral character, our values, or even our emotional and psychological maturity, all of which would have traditionally been included as part of what we meant by spiritual growth. But there's been this kind of breaking off just where we say, well, look, you know, even the most enlightened people seem to be jerks, so obviously whatever enlightenment is doesn't really mean all that much. It's just a single line of development. Maybe it gives you access to higher states of consciousness, but it doesn't really grow you as a human being. And I think that's the key, is this notion that our humanity is not really ultimately transformable, or at least not as a result of spiritual work. And naturally, of course, a slew of spiritual commentators have emerged to help us make sense of this predicament in terms of, you know, the predicament I laid out at the beginning of people not really achieving the results that they had hoped for from their practice. We've had books with titles like After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, which was a popular book several years ago, which really made an argument that the ecstasy of spiritual life was in fact just a stage that we pass through on our way to the tedious laundry room of sustained spiritual practice. Another Buddhist commentary even added a noble truth to Buddhism. You know, Buddhism's classic four noble truths: life is suffering, the origin of suffering is attachment, the cessation of suffering is attainable, and there is a path to the cessation of suffering, and that would be the Noble Eightfold Path. This commentator added a noble truth, which was that suffering is manageable, the point being that most of us won't ever rise above the world of neurotic suffering, of samsara, but we can learn to deal with our neuroses more gracefully. And I maybe sound a little tongue-in-cheek in bringing this up. I don't mean to beat up on these commentators. I mean, I think, honestly, the people who wrote those books, who've made these points, and there are, you know, dozens of examples, I think they're genuinely responding to their own and other people's real experiences on the path. But I do think that, you know, if we're ever going to find our way to the kind of radical spiritual attainment that we sense is possible, we need to at least step back this much and look and see at what the kind of what the high points of the conversation are in the spiritual world right now. So, and I also just want to say that I want to make it clear I don't think this predicament that we're in is anybody's fault. I just think it has to do with the intersection of a number of cultural currents converging right now. But rather than start by analyzing those cultural currents, what I want to do first today is to explore what authentic spiritual transformation really is and why it is that it is so exceedingly rare in this world. Because I'm convinced that by illuminating what it is and why it's so rare, that there will also be a possibility then of illuminating how those of us who really are sincerely interested in such a transformation could begin to make some changes in our approach that would enable us to bring about this kind of transformation for ourselves. So I want to start by talking about the goal. What really is the goal of the spiritual path? We all hear words like enlightenment, self-realization, nirvana, God realization, and we all have ideas about what these words point to. And I'm going to try to talk about these words in human terms, in experiential terms. In other words, what it means for us human beings to really go all the way. And I really don't want this to be a theoretical exercise. I'm going to be speaking about this as directly as I can. And so before I go into this, I really would encourage you and invite you to try to listen from a different part of yourself than you might be accustomed to listening from. I want to invite you to step into what we might call the mind of wisdom. I want to invite you to step into the part of yourself that is already infinitely wise, the mind that already knows the sacred truth of existence, and listen from there. So what is this higher possibility that the great sages throughout the ages have pointed toward? What was it that we have sensed in our deepest spiritual moments as an extraordinary breakthrough for human beings, an extraordinary transformative potential? I think many of us have sensed that it's possible to come into a kind of a deep, a profound, and even a kind of perfect relationship with life, with the cosmos, with the divine, the sacred. I think we know in some level that it's possible for life to make perfect sense. It's possible for your life to make perfect sense. It's possible to come into such a profound alignment with the moral and spiritual axis of the universe that every moment of your life is a walk in grace, and that you know without any doubt that you're in the right place at the right time. It's really possible for all existential doubt to actually disappear. It's possible to live with unwavering conviction in the inherent goodness of life. It's possible to awaken so deeply to the divine evolutionary principle at the heart of existence that we know that we're living our lives for the highest purpose there is. And in this knowing, to discover an unimaginable and abiding liberation from the suffering of our confused, neurotic, separate sense of self. It's possible to be truly a free human being. And I want to acknowledge that what I'm speaking about here is a completely different kind of human life than most of us have ever encountered, except perhaps in a meeting with a truly realized sage. And you can see in what I'm talking about that it's not simply about being in the now or loving and accepting what is in every moment. It's not just about accessing a more expansive state of awareness or being able to stand back and abide as the witness of everything that arises. Those are all good things to cultivate, good experiences to have. But what I'm trying to speak about here is authentic God realization, And I'm using the word God for a reason today, not because I'm primarily a theist. I'm really not. But because when we're speaking about this, we need to use words that symbolize ultimacy. And we don't have a lot of words for that other than God in our language. So this authentic God realization is one where the ego itself has been overridden by the ultimate principle, by the divine creative force of the cosmos, by what Gautama Buddha called the roar of the timeless beyond. It's a life where any personal motive to have and get for ourselves, to protect ourselves, has been replaced by a burning passion to give everything for the greatest good. And in this ultimate submission to the Absolute, the human being becomes a living, breathing force for our higher evolution. And those of you who've met a truly great realized master, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about when I describe this. You felt it in their presence. It was an earth-shattering, shocking realization. Who they were was a demonstration of a kind of potential that made them almost seem more than human, even as they were really just demonstrating what it meant to be truly human. Now, experientially, I think it's also good to look at what this means, because when one steps over the line and into this other way of being, one finds oneself in a state of profound receptivity and openness. There's a kind of transparency, and one is sort of just a kind of transparent, open, vibrant vessel for this infinite power and force to shine through, to come through. At times there's a remarkable mental clarity, but there's no desire left to cling on to that clarity. Insights just come and go, but there's this deep knowledge that I can't hold on to any of this, so there's no grasping on. There might be a kind of powerful intuitive knowing emerge at times, but then it will just disappear again. You know, it's sort of there when it's needed, and when it's not, it's gone. But there's no kind of clinging, holding on in the center. Spiritual experiences come and go. All kinds of human experiences come and go. Difficult emotions, positive emotions. The whole panoply of the human experience flows through such a being. But there's no longer any clinging to any of it. There's no longer any resistance to any of it. All of the experience is allowed to be there and seen for what it is. And more importantly, I would say, and contrary in some ways to popular belief, in this one awakens to a profound awareness of what we might call the moral order of the cosmos. There's a recognition of what I assume was meant by words like the Tao or the Dharma in traditional terms, where you become aware of a kind of law, a kind of the way things are and the way things should be. Kind of principle that makes you into a real agitator in a sense, because you are deeply aware of a kind of rightness, and you become motivated to try to make things right, make things line up with that. And this is something that operates for you not cognitively, I mean it includes that, but it's also even emotionally, you feel in a sense for the whole of life. You feel the pain of the whole, you feel the ecstasy of the whole as your own pain and your own ecstasy, and really the boundaries between oneself and the whole of existence are gone. You are in a sense truly the seeing, sensing, feeling organ of the whole, of the cosmos. And at the center of one's being is this burning passion for evolution and transformation, a kind of calling to transform the world into an expression of the divinity that you've discovered. Now, anybody who goes this far out there becomes a kind of, I guess what we might call almost an evolutionary freak. It's a bit like the comic books and movies about the X-Men, where human beings start mutating and these new mutants have various superhuman powers. and society fears them and yet adores them at the same time. Now, in spiritual realization, it's not about superhuman powers in the sense of being able to fly or bend metal with your mind or anything like that, although, of course, the spiritual lore is filled with stories like that, but I think those are largely metaphorical. I'm open-minded. But it's not about that, but it's really that one's values, one's sense of what's real and important undergoes such a fundamental break with the status quo that in some senses the person just seems to have gone beyond what we normally think of as the human condition. In fact, and this isn't something new, what I'm saying here. There's a story of the Buddha shortly after his awakening walking down the road, and he encounters this person. And the person is so overwhelmed by the Buddha's presence that he asks, "Who are you? Are you a god?" And the Buddha famously answered, with all humility, "No, I'm awake." But I think what this story illustrates, in addition to the Buddha's humility, is that to ordinary human eyes, the awakened one seems more than human, larger than life in many ways. Now, all of what I'm describing, I know in some ways the way I'm going at this makes it sound very big and beyond reach, and that's not my intention. But I want to make it clear that this is not big and beyond reach. I mean, it is big, but it's not beyond reach. It's not a pipe dream drawn from ancient books. This is what it's really like. It's what it's always been about. And it's really what is about now. This is what's possible for a human life to become. And I hope that in saying that, I'm ultimately just confirming your own sense of what's possible, even if you've been told so many times now that it's really not anymore. Now, the thing is, just because it's possible to awaken to this radically different kind of life doesn't mean that it's easy. Indeed, what I'm describing is probably pretty clearly by now, without question, the most challenging endeavor that a human being could possibly undertake. And the reason is that to do this, to allow something so glorious to take over your life from the inside out, you have to be willing to let everything go. You have to be willing to give up all of the strategies, the ego strategies that have worked so well for you in your life up until now. One has to be willing to let go completely of one's self-image. We need to leave behind all of our ideas about who we are. There's even a kind of sacrificial element to this where it's about leaving behind concern for your own welfare. It's not that you're, in a sense, I don't mean putting yourself physically at risk in any way, but there's a certain way in which there's a deep letting go of any concern for what's going to happen to me. There's just a recognition that there's something so much more important than me here, and I have to align with this, I have to give myself to this, and I don't care what happens to me in it. You know, it's like the old phrase, "Lord, you know, do with me what you will." And this is real. And it is ultimately a radical leap into a completely different way of being, which has appropriately been described as a kind of death, a death of the ego. And, you know, this kind of ultimate submission to this cosmic or divine will has always been the ultimate challenge. And as many of today's most insightful spiritual commentators have pointed out, it might even be more of a challenge now than it ever was, for the simple reason that those of us who are spiritually seeking today are far more self-absorbed and self-conscious than any of our predecessors. After all, right, we live in the age of the individual, and this has brought us many good things. It's brought us greater individual freedom and power, but it's also made us deeply resistant to surrendering ourselves over to a greater wisdom, a greater power, and a greater will. And I'd like to just take a moment to ask you to think about this for yourself. Again, I want to bring this out of the abstract in any way. How willing are you to surrender control over your life to a greater intelligence? How willing are you to even acknowledge the existence of something greater than yourself? I want to do a little exercise here, which I want you to ask yourself. If imagine that God showed up incarnate before you and proved his or her existence to you beyond any doubt, and then told you to abandon your life and follow him or her into the infinite, would you be willing to let everything go? I mean everything. All of your plans, your hopes, your dreams, your relationships. Would you just say, oh my God, I've met God and God needs something from me and I'm going to give it? Or would you ask for some time to consider the implications? Would you fear for the loss of your independence? I think it's useful to think about these things because most of us simply assume that we're naturally interested in living a spiritual life. Who wouldn't be, right? But we need to really reckon with how far we're ready to go. What is it that we're really aiming for? And see, we have to recognize that even if we, who we think we are, even if we feel deeply that we want to surrender to the divine, that if we have a burning in our heart that we would want nothing more than to just give ourselves to that glorious possibility to be an agent of evolution, there is also a big part of us that probably wants nothing to do with that, a part of us that desperately wants to maintain control, to keep things small and manageable. And my hope in sharing what I've said so far is that it might begin to make it clear why it is that authentic spiritual transformation is so rare, because it is and always has been such a big thing, an ultimate sacrifice, something that requires everything you have to give and a whole lot more. Now, I want to talk a little bit about our moment in history in relation to all this, because there's a kind of great irony facing us right now, which is that here we are in the midst of this great spiritual renaissance. Millions of us are seeking for spiritual growth. We have all the wisdom of the world at our fingertips. In any major city, there are dozens of workshops, seminars, retreats, meditation groups, yoga classes offered every week, if not every day, to help us become more spiritual. And all of these things clearly do something. They clearly work. They deliver some benefit. It's possible to change our old patterns, to cultivate new capacities, to become less selfish, more compassionate, many other things. But unless we enter the arena of genuine ego transcendence, we aren't really any closer to the ultimate goal. And we're not really any closer to the kind of change that changes everything. And the thing about our moment in history that makes this such a challenge is that nearly all of our spiritual practices are being engaged within a context of self-improvement. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, even if we want to talk about our pursuit of enlightenment and our higher aspirations for enlightenment, the context that we have to do that within is really largely our own self, our attempt to change ourself in a positive way. And I want to just contrast this with the context within which mysticism traditionally occurred, or transformative spiritual practice traditionally occurred. That was always some sort of larger religious mythic context. We had a big framework around our practice. There were belief systems. There was either we believed in a God that we were, you know, attempting to serve or attempting to align with or become united with, or we believed in a realm of celestial bodhisattvas who were looking down on us and, you know, feeding us and also, you know, needing something from us. There was always, and we were woven together in these religious structures where we all had a shared, you know, mythic belief system and a kind of support system. There was a hierarchy of teacher and discipleship. And the context really wasn't just the self. It was something bigger always. But right now in postmodernity, there's not any context left other than the self, and at least not one we can collectively agree upon. So in a sense, the improvement of the self is our only framework for spiritual practice. And as you can see, given what is involved in reaching the spiritual goal here, it requires us to go completely beyond ourselves, to really give up ourselves in a fundamental way. And so we're in this kind of double bind. And I feel it's that's primarily what's making it so difficult for people, in spite of all of the relative change that we can undergo, to really surrender in the way that I've been speaking about, and to allow something much greater to really enter our lives and guide our lives fundamentally. So I think the question confronting all of us right now is, how can we discover a context greater than the self, a context big enough to take us beyond ourself? Because I know that there is a lot of sincere practice going on. We want to do this, but I think for many it's a question of how, and feeling a little stuck. Now, I hope this isn't too abstract for folks. I realize these kinds of discussions can veer toward the theoretical and abstract, and my goal today is really not to do that. And so maybe rather than give an abstract answer to this question I posed of how are we going to get beyond the self, I think it might be useful to just share a little bit from my own personal spiritual journey that I think might help to ground this whole conversation for us. And I'll try to do the quick version here. But just to let you know a little bit about me, I began seeking spiritually at a pretty early age. I was raised in a relatively agnostic Unitarian family, but by my early teens, I had gotten the tug through a few friends and friends' parents and a teacher in our school, and I started to pursue spiritual life. I was reading books on Eastern and Western mysticism. I started meditating as a teenager, experimented with some psychedelic substances, and through all of that, I had many early powerful spiritual experiences that convinced me beyond any doubt that there was more to life. I mean, I think I was probably 14 when I had this very clear recognition that the whole thing could be completely different, that there was a possibility for, not just for my experience of life, but for how people were together, for the whole human endeavor to be radically transformed into something beautiful, and that was just true about life, and that really we were all living in a kind of delusion and not seeing what was possible. And that really propelled me on my path. By my early 20s, I was really seeking very earnestly. During my college years, I taught meditation workshops on my campus. I gave talks on spiritual topics. I traveled to Asia and spent time meditating there and visiting monasteries and wise people. And I was always somebody who was sort of naturally prone to spiritual experience, and so it was easy for me to have, you know, powerful openings and awakenings at various points. And I had decided, after I had minored in religious studies and was on my way to Harvard Divinity School to do my graduate work in world mysticism, when my life took a dramatic turn. And that was when I met a spiritual teacher who, in a moment, really revealed to me everything I had been seeking for. That teacher, as I think you all know by now, was Andrew Cohen, and my meeting with him catalyzed such a profound awakening that I knew my life as I had known it was over, that nothing would ever be the same again. And I promptly canceled my graduate school plans, quit my job, and, you know, did something that to many would look very irresponsible, but for me I had no choice, which was I moved to a spiritual community to live closer to my new teacher and his community of students. And for the next 13 years, I participated in a kind of extraordinary evolutionary experiment, living side by side with this remarkable group of people, all committed to their own evolution and to really supporting one another on this path. And when I say on this path, it was a path not just about our own spiritual transformation, but we were really, under Andrew's guidance, trying to pioneer a new collective enlightenment, a new culture, in a sense, that was really rooted beyond ego. And this was our actual engagement. This was our practice, and it was supported by a lot of personal practice. But that was our deep aspiration, and we got a lot of amazing results, as some of you, I'm sure, have read. But When I came to my teacher, I was what you might call a textbook case of the kind of overinflated male ego. In my outward life, I had been very dedicated to service. I had this kind of persona of being a kind of loving, caring, sensitive New Age guy. I taught outward bound courses to troubled youth. I worked as a crisis counselor. I worked with the mentally disabled. I did all kinds of service work. And I was, I had a nice air of caring and compassion about me, and I even did a pretty good act of being the sort of wise, enlightened one. But underneath all this, I was about as arrogant and narcissistic as they come. I was kind of bright, charismatic, and charming, and completely full of myself. And I honestly think my only saving grace on the path was that I knew I was full of BS. I would guess I was maybe smart enough to, or self-aware enough to know that I was really narcissistic and really arrogant and really self-absorbed. And I found that painful because of the spiritual impulse that was there and that I was following. And I knew that I was like, here I was trying to be a spiritual person, but deep down it was like about as far away from it as I could get. And I really knew there was a much greater possibility for my life, and I did not know how to get there. And Andrew saw straight through me from the very first word. I mean, he saw my potential and he held me to that, but he also saw all of my ego strategies and he didn't hesitate to let me know. I mean, even shortly after we met, I remember he sat me down and told me, it was this talk I could never forget. He said, you're obviously very bright, talented, and charismatic, and I'm sure this has served you well in life, but it's not going to do you any good here. You're going to have to let go of your attachment to all of that if you really want to be free. And he was definitely right. And I mean, I would say the first several years of my tutelage with him were in many ways a kind of spiritual roller coaster ride, where really deep and sustained spiritual openings and experiences would be followed by these kind of grueling assaults on my ego, which would then lead to even deeper awakenings and experiences. But it was definitely, a lot of hard work. But what I really wanted to share today, that's just kind of a little background, but what I wanted to share was a point at which something fundamentally shifted for me. And it has to do with what we're talking about here. I had been with Andrew for many years at the point when this shift happened. I mean, I had done intensive spiritual practice. I had been on several long retreats, including a 6-month solitary meditation retreat. I had had, like I said, many openings and awakenings of all different kinds. But I knew deep down that I still was not free in the fundamental sense. And that really, despite everything that had happened, all the guidance I had been given, etc., I was still plagued by existential doubt, by my own self-absorption tendencies, by my arrogance, and kind of just a fundamental self-preoccupation with how I was doing on the path. And for those of you who don't know Andrew, he has a reputation for being a fierce and uncompromising teacher. And needless to say, he wasn't too happy with the fact that after all of his help, after all of that spiritual practice and guidance, and really more spiritual experience than any human being could hope for, that I kept falling back into my old egocentric patterns of behavior. And I think also he had seen my potential for leadership in the community and the teachings, and he wasn't really going to accept anything less from me than my full potential. So one day he calls me into his office, and I didn't know what he wanted, but he asked me to sit down. And he just sort of shared with me his frustration that I wasn't yet really living up to my own potential or to my own realization, in a sense, what I had actually seen and experienced for myself, that I wasn't really a consistent sort of shining beacon of spiritual strength. But he also shared his conviction that I could be so much more, and that a massive shift, was not something that had to be far away. And I remember the way he was looking at me. It was almost as if he was kind of puzzled, looking me over, trying to figure out the key that would unlock the door to, my real transformation. And I remember he just looked at me and he said, what if you were to give up on your personal enlightenment project and start caring about the evolution of the human race? What if you were to accept that the future of life, humanity, and consciousness itself really did depend on you transcending your ego once and for all. And I don't know what it was about that moment, because in many ways it wasn't a new message. And I don't know why that particular day it got through. I think it might have been something about his innocent confidence that I could simply make the shift that kind of allowed me to be open to the possibility. But as I began to let in his words, I began to feel a subtle axial shift inside myself. I mean, it wasn't a big spiritual experience, anything like I had experienced prior to that, but I just knew on some fundamental level that something was going to be different from there. And over the days and weeks that followed, I found myself in a nearly constant contemplation of what he had said. What would it mean to give up my personal quest for my own enlightenment? What would it mean to live my life for a cosmic purpose? What would it mean to give myself over to this greater motive for transformation? And as this contemplation started to consume me, it was like something deep within just started to kind of overtake me. I think what I just began to accept on the deepest level of my being, the reality of our collective evolutionary predicament. I was just seeing for myself the recognition that we are all part of this vast cosmic evolutionary unfolding, and that we humans are really on the growing edge of that unfolding, at least here in this corner of the cosmos, and that the choices that we make are determining the direction and the rate of the evolution of this process. And I think the deep piece that was just clicking into place for me was this recognition of something Andrew had said many times before, which is that God and evolution really need us at this point, that we're always approaching the divine as kind of spiritual beggars looking for God to help us on our path. But the truth is, at this point, if we recognize that we're part of a larger evolutionary trajectory that's reaching and striving toward greater orders of harmony and integration and unity, that the only way that's going to happen is through human choice, through my choice. And I started to see really that I was one of the lucky people who had the opportunity to be exposed to this kind of deep spiritual vision, you know, in a world full of people who are still by and large mostly in survival, you know, and not necessarily surviving very well. And here I was the recipient of all of this wisdom, of this luxurious Western lifestyle, and that I had this moral obligation to basically to line up with this evolutionary, what Andrew calls the evolutionary impulse, to line up with it and to serve it and to live according to it with everything I had, and that anything less than that from me would be selling God out, in a sense. It would be selling the life process out. It would be taking for granted things that should never be taken for granted. And I mean, the way it landed in my soul, I guess I would say, was just this deep recognition that my life isn't my own life. I saw how, you know, in some way I had always kind of thought that, well, ultimately I only have myself to answer to, you know. Ultimately it's, you know, the bottom line is, you know, I am my own context, I guess, like I spoke about earlier. But it was like that just got shattered in this kind of heartbreaking way. I mean, it was, I have to say, for about a week there, as I was in this contemplation, every time I would think about this deep truth of what I guess I would call our evolutionary interdependence, this deep truth that you know, we all affect each other, we all live in each other, we all are beholden to each other and to this whole process to give everything we can to lift it up. It was like every time I would even think about that, I would kind of start to cry almost. It was like my heart was kind of breaking with this recognition of being beholden to this cosmic sacred process. And it was really nothing like any of the kind of non-dual awakenings that I had undergone previously, in which there was just sort of this recognition of an inherent perfection, even with all the imperfection. it wasn't that at all. It was really this, that there was this kind of this love for the human, for all of existence, but also this pain at all of the needless suffering that's brought on by all of our collective ignorance, and this imminent kind of sense that it didn't have to be this way, that that again the whole world could be a luminous expression of this divine order and perfection if only humanity could align with this cosmic force of love and truth. And I have to say this, I mean, it was so all-consuming that I had no choice at that point to start kind of expressing this to others in my community, others. And part of the thing was being in a community of other people who were so deeply committed to this process, there was a very clear sort of, I started to see in a very clear, tangible way that I could literally be a catalyst for evolution through the stand I was willing to take for evolution, you know, through my willingness to like be a stand for the truth, that it would have a huge ripple effect on other people. And simultaneously, to the degree that I would make room for my ego's, you know, less wholesome motives, maybe to just be lazy or sit back or play it safe or, you know, be self-concerned, that the moment I would pull back into myself in any way, that also exerted a negative pull on the evolution of the collective. And in a sense, I could see that this small collective I was in was a sort of microcosm for this macrocosm of the whole world, where really every important choice any of us make is affecting the whole, either for good or in a sense of pushing evolution forward, or we're kind of holding this process back. And so what I want to say is this wasn't in some way like the end of my spiritual path, but it marked this fundamental shift in my orientation, which I, to this day, I know changed everything. It marked the beginning of a kind of deepening alignment with this evolutionary impulse. And in that, it's like what it did is it created ground for me to take on my own ego and all of my own negative tendencies in a way that was just, was absolute. It was, you know, there were battles still to be fought with the ego, but it was like I was on the right side of the battle for once. You know, I was willing to pay the price of transformation, which meant to let go of what I needed to let go of, to face what I needed to face in order to stay true to this holy, sacred context that had revealed itself. And in this, great leaps started to become possible that prior to that would have seemed unimaginable. And so the reason I've shared this story is I'm not just trying to add another spiritual autobiography to the archives. We have plenty of them out there. And I'm really sharing this because, in a sense, in the years since this happened to me, I've really seen that this is not a unique personal story. This wasn't just, you know, my little anomaly, but there are important elements of it that I think are kind of archetypal for our spiritual moment in history. Because remember, prior to this event, I mean, I had done decades of spiritual practice. I had undergone all this, you know, mind-blowing experiences and insights and awakenings. I had experienced the sustained non-dual, non-egoic consciousness for periods of time, and I had been committed to this 24/7 semi-monastic spiritual life for about half a dozen years, but my ego was still firmly in the driver's seat, and in this realignment, it really got out of the driver's seat. And so what was it that shifted there? In my own case, I would say I discovered a deeper motive for transformation. It's like I discovered, and it's really almost more like I finally accepted that God and evolution needed me to step up and live my life for a greater purpose. You know, I realized my life wasn't my own, and that gave me the strength and the will, I guess, ultimately, to begin to really do the deep spiritual work and of self-transcendence that up to that point, I guess I hadn't been willing to do. And to really let myself go and let something else move into the center of my life. So I think the kind of point I want to try to make is that spiritual transformation is such a big thing that most of us simply won't do it for ourselves. it's kind of this self, this kind of vicious cycle where, you know, if the only reason that we want to wake up is to feel better, we'll never do the work required to wake up, because there's so much of that work is doesn't make you feel better. So much of that work is really, in a sense, much deeper kind of suffering than the normal, ordinary, neurotic, egoic suffering that we normally go through. So there's this way, as long as we're in it for ourselves, we won't really make the leap we have to make. And so I honestly feel at this point, you know, because I think we can't go back to the mythic context. I mean, some of us can, but by and large, most of us are not going to go back and believe that there's a God in the sky with a beard who's going to shake his finger at us and cry if we don't take, you know, do our, you know, spiritual practice or whatever. We're not going back. And so I think we need to go forward and discover a deeper motive, a compelling, non-personal reason to transform. And so where do we find it? You know, it's my contention that the compelling reason that can give anybody the strength to change and to really discover the kind of glorious transformation that we all sense is possible is when we deeply see the truth of our context, when we accept that evolution's up to us, that the divine process really needs us, needs me. You know, that I can't wait for anybody else to do it. That there's no, you know, like Andrew Cohen spoke about on this series, that there's no time left to wait from the point of view of the absolute. You know, we have to do it now. And what do I have to do now? And I feel like that's the reorientation that can change it all. So I want to take a few moments here before we go to the questions to just talk about, you know, so how do we make this real for ourselves? How do we take this out of the abstract and make it into the central organizing principle for our lives? And I mean, I'm hoping it's clear by now why I'm saying that meditation alone won't do the job, that, you know, no matter how much kind of inner powerful awareness we cultivate, that there's some real ego deconstruction that needs to be done and some real deep realignment of our values and motives and priorities and our will. And I hope it's clear why I would also say that doing more psychotherapy or what's been called shadow work probably wouldn't do it either. I mean, these practices are great, but what we need to work on most is really shifting our context, our motivational center. And hang on just a sec. Claire, I think Claire just came on the line and we're hearing a lot of noise. Maybe you want to hit mute, Claire? Okay, just hit mute for now. So psychotherapy and shadow work, again, these things are good, but what we really need to work on is this contextual shift. And I think we just have to fundamentally come to terms with what we're doing here. And honestly, I think, in my experience, the most powerful tool we have for doing that is direct contemplation. You see, and I just want to take a moment to make this point. It's come up a few times throughout the series, which is this point that we postmoderns, you know, we have a much greater self-awareness and introspective capacity than any previous generation did. That this is really we're in a new developmental stage where we're much more aware of our interiors, and there's been a lot of talk about how that makes us more self-absorbed, and in that sense, it's a kind of a curse. But I think it can also be leveraged to our own advantage, and toward this end, I'm just going to share with you some resources that I've created that are completely free for you to go and experiment with. I've on the integralenlightenment.com website, I've put together a bunch of practices that I call inquiry practices. There's transformative inquiry practices, engaged inquiry practices, and inquiry practices to prepare us for meditation. There's three different categories. But all of these are really designed toward this end, to try to use our ability to reflect more deeply on ourselves to help bring about this realignment in our values, in our motive, in our priorities, our will. And I was going to give some of them out here, but I'm realizing I'm running out of time. So I think I will just maybe point you to that spot on the site. I mean, well, I'll give you an example here. So here's just a couple quick examples. So maybe every morning before you do anything else, take 10 minutes and sit down and contemplate what it is that you're really living for. Ask yourself, what's the most important thing in life? What is of ultimate significance? And what do I need to do today to align with that, to be an expression of that in the world? If it's helpful, you can do this as a journal exercise, or you can just do it in silent reflection, maybe before you do your meditation. And then every evening, take another 10 minutes and ask yourself these same questions, but in looking back on your day and asking, was I really aligned with this thing of ultimate significance? Was I really aligned with the most important thing? Or was I just getting lost again? And, you know, and again, it can be a journal exercise. So this is just one small example. I've got a lot of these on the site that you can do, and a lot more detailed instructions about how to do them. But I think this is at least part, because again, we're talking about something very big, and it is challenging. A lot of people say, well, how do I do this? And even just contemplating it seems hard. But I mean, it is hard. We're talking about an evolutionary leap and a rewiring of really what drives us as a person in the world. And it's going to take, you know, a willingness to struggle with ourselves, to reflect deeply. And the last piece I want to say, and maybe somebody, if anybody asks a question about this, we can go more into it there, but is that honestly, this is a really hard thing to do on your own. And truthfully, I do feel that I just need to, you know, I'd be lying if I said, yeah, just go do these practices in the privacy of your own little life and they'll, you know, take you all the way. Because I think the truth is, if we really are serious, we do need community. We obviously need guidance. Sally and I and Genpo and I, you know, several of us, I mean, throughout this series, we've really talked about the need for a teacher and for guidance. It's kind of come out of everybody's mouth. But, you know, and we have a lot of teachers around now, and you have to kind of use your own judgment to find one that really works for you. But so we have that. We have a lot of teachings available to us. But it is very hard in our modern world, where we're all really busy living our individual lives, to find a context of a deep enough and sustained enough of community engagement with people who are really committed to the same thing we are, committed to this radical evolution. And so I want to put it out there that I think we need to seek for that, and we need to find ways. And if we don't find the structures around us that, or structures out there that appeal to us, we need to be generative and create them. And again, I've put forward some free resources on the integralenlightenment.com site for people who want to start groups, want to start building community locally, with meeting guides and principles of engagement and how to hold a meeting and group practices. So again, if you want to pioneer this, you know, yourself, there's a lot of free structures there that you can take advantage of. And you know, I will just confess, I do have some larger community aspirations starting to brew for the creation of a kind of evolutionary, integral, residential, spiritual community out here in the Bay Area that will be a really brand new model for community, kind of attempting to embody all the best insights of integral and evolutionary spirituality in a kind of post-traditional context that really is making a lot of room for individual creativity and freedom. But you know, different aspects of guidance involved as well. So if that's something that you feel pulled to, you know, stay tuned. I'll be coming out with that at some point. But anyway, just a few last words, and then we'll go to the questions. The last words I want to leave you with, and I think the deepest message of my talk today, is that if you feel moved by the spiritual impulse, and if you have a sense that something extraordinary is possible, don't settle for less than the ultimate. Don't believe those who tell you that enlightenment is just about accepting things as they are, or that your humanity can't be transformed into a shining beacon of light and goodness. Stay true to your deepest intuition that an extraordinary life, a miraculous, holy life is possible. Strive for it, surrender to it, and don't ever stop reaching for it. So I'll end with that, and thank you very much. We'll now kind of move into the next phase, the Q&A part.
Thank you, Craig. I know I speak for all of us when I say that we really appreciated your talk this morning. And we're looking forward to hearing the questions that people have in response to it. If you have a question for Craig, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and wait until we ask for a question from someone in your region of the world. We'll take some callers first and then go ahead onto the instant messages.
But before we take your questions, I want to mention a few of our sponsors. First, I want to tell you a bit about our co-hosts for this event, Integral Life. If you're enjoying this event today, you'll love Integral Life, featuring over 150 hours of audio and video discussions with today's great thinkers, leaders, visionaries, and artists, mostly moderated by Ken Wilber. They're making up a special offer for all participants in the Great Integral Awakening. You can sign up for their premium membership and get your first month free and receive a DVD, 2-CD set with all of their content from 1 month shipped to you for free. Just go to startyourintegrallife.com. That's startyourintegrallife.com. And on the subject of free, if you haven't visited integralenlightenment.com, go there today and download our free guided meditation, Opening to the Great Perfection, led by Craig Hamilton. At integralenlightenment.com, you'll also find a collection of free audios, articles, and videos exploring what it means to live an authentic spiritual life in today's world. I also want to tell you about some of our other sponsors for this series. The series is sponsored in part by Now and Zen, makers of Zen alarm clocks and meditation timers. Zen clocks feature natural acoustic chimes and gongs, which wake you up gracefully and naturally. I actually have one. They're fantastic. They also serve as aesthetically sophisticated timers for spiritual practice. All Now and Zen products have been invented by integral philosopher Steve McIntosh, and the company strives to create products that reflect beauty and a lifestyle of sustainability and progressive spirituality. You can see their extensive line at www.now-zen.com. That's now-zen.com. And this teleseminar is also sponsored in part by The Shift, a movie being made by a movement. We're in the middle of the biggest social transformation in human history, The Shift. The Shift movie raises awareness to the story of our roles in an evolutionary shift of our collective consciousness. As it chronicles the faces and stories and leaders assisting in their social transformation, the film reveals its emergence and meaning. View the powerful trailer that over 1 million people have downloaded and sign up for their mailing list at www.theshiftmovie.com. That's theshiftmovie.com. Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions. If you have a question for Craig, again, simply send us your question via instant message on the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number that you see on your screen. Wait until we ask for a question of someone who lives in your region in the world. When we ask for live questions, I'm going to unmute the lines and remute the lines so that people can press star 6. And I think first up, we'll take a message from the west coast of the United States. So just one moment, I'll just change the conference line structure here.
All callers are unmuted. All callers are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing star 6.
Okay, so let's start with the west coast of the United States. If you have a question, just press star 6 to unmute your line, to say your name and the city you're from. Hi there. What's your name and city you're from?
I'm Fiona Ray. I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Fiona from Portland. What's your question? Go right ahead.
Well, I was intrigued when he was mentioning about wanting to start a community, and I'm actually here in Portland and have about 120 acres 25 miles outside of Portland, and that's my intention as well. So I was wondering, how can I collaborate or get that out there?
Great. Craig, do you want to respond?
Yeah, sure. Great to meet you. So I think that's probably a little, maybe a better question for off-air in some way, because it's more, you know, it's going to be more logistical and tactical and all that. But I appreciate you putting it out. And so could you send me an email at send it to craig@integralenlightenment.com, just making the connection, reminding me that we talked about this, and then I'll be in touch. And in fact, I'm going to be in Portland soon, so maybe we can connect and talk about it. Okay.
Thanks,
Felix. Great, I appreciate it.
Great, just press star 6 to reach your line.
Good to know the community impulse is everywhere.
Great, there's someone else from the West Coast of the United States. Just press star 6.
Hello.
Hello. All right, so let's say Central United States. Anyone have a question from...
I'm from Michigan, I don't know...
Okay, well, let's take your question. What's your name and the city you're from?
You go first, sir. No, the other guy, you go ahead.
My name's Jay. I'm from the East Coast.
Okay, well, let's go right ahead with your question, Jay. Which city are you from?
I'm from the East Coast, Groton, Massachusetts.
Okay, great. Go ahead, and your question?
Well, I just wanted to give recognition because it was beautiful listening to you, Craig. It's like a reflection of self. You took us through the venue of your spiritual life. And you know, I started off at a point where I was on stilts and took the peak, and then you have to go back and build that lattice work. It's not easy stuff. But, you know, in terms of the mythical... because there, a matter of fact, I'll just quote one thing that was from, I think it was from Revelations, that said, "Behold the beast that was, is not, yet is." And that is the ego. I mean, like, there's a different way we can look at some of these old texts with the new consciousness. And it's almost like a cattle prod. Because, you know, sometimes it's so easy to... take that slippery slope, like you were talking about, getting full of yourself, and because enlightenment has some byproducts to it that can be negative as well. When we think we're doing it all, sometimes we're the tree in the way of the forest, and our job is the forest. And it's a matter of fact, there's a site called Mission of Maitreyus, which is maitreya.org, and he has a very interesting perspective on a lot of old texts.
Yeah, let me. I'll jump in there. And the interesting thought that I heard there is that, you know, you mentioned how the ego is something that maybe is a retranslation or a new understanding of a very old idea, which has to do with, you know, basically the part of ourselves that is really not excited about God, that doesn't want to be free. And I think one interesting thing about this in the new evolutionary paradigm is that we can start to recognize that, you know, because, I mean, this is a great point that Michael Dowd likes to make, is that, you know, everybody in the kind of post-modernity has rejected the notion of original sin, or that we're somehow born with these deep flaws in our character. But if we understand this from an evolutionary perspective, the truth is that we are born with deep flaws in our character. It's not that some Satan character made us that way. It's really our ancient inherited evolutionary proclivities that...
Yeah, illusion. Illusion. Hmm.
Well, illusion might be part of it, but what I'm really talking about is, you know, the fact that humans, you know, we're really animals fundamentally. I mean, we've evolved... the vast tracts of our evolution were spent as, you know, you use the word beasts. The vast tracts of our evolution were spent as beasts, and we've only recently attained kind of powers of reflective consciousness and started to, you know, have the power to make moral choices and rise up out of what is essentially a kind of red in tooth and claw nature. And so, you know, it's no surprise that there are parts of ourselves that really are opposed to our higher evolution. I mean, opposed to is maybe even making it a little too willful. It's just that there's deep conditioning that wants nothing to do with these higher potentials. And
well, it's almost like there's a lower self and a graduation to higher self. And the higher self, sometimes we don't know when we've crossed this line, but we do it. It's when we've gone beyond the third chakra and move into the heart chakra. There's three chakras of crudifying.
Sir, I appreciate. We just don't have a lot of time, and I need to make some room for some other some of the other callers.
Yes, of course.
But I really appreciate your call, so thank you.
Thank you. If you can just press star 6 to remute your line. And if anyone has unmuted their line, if you can just press star 6 to remute your line. Craig, I'm just going to pass on a question that we have coming in over the webcast. This is from Derwin Foster, North Vancouver. You speak about giving up self-concern and control. That is challenging enough as one person. But let's just assume an individual has enough passion to take this stance as an individual. What about an individual who has children? I have 3 young children. How does a person take this stance when you have young children that need to be cared for?
I honestly don't understand the question. How do you take what stance?
The stance of giving up self-concern and control.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're saying giving up concern for your... I assumed that what Derwin's asking is, you know, how do I give up concern for my children as a kind of an extension of self-concern? And,
right.
And I would say don't give up concern for your children. But what I think that what you're pointing to is... It's good because it's a kind of deeper question that I think a lot of us have when we say, okay, you know, if I'm going to surrender myself to, like, let's go ahead and enter into theistic language here because I think it's helpful for this particular piece of the conversation. So let's say there's a God. Let's say there is what I've described as this divine, evolutionary, conscious, intelligent force and presence that really is the creative principle behind this whole unfolding event. And let's say that I'm right, that it has a kind of will, meaning that there's a kind of moral order to the cosmos that's asking for us, calling for us to align with it. And so then the question would be, so see, it's interesting because then when we think about aligning with that, the first thing we think about, well, what about me? What about my concerns? What about, you know, what if things don't go the way I want them to? And then you bring up an extension of that, which is, well, gee, I have other obligations, family to care for. I mean, there could be anything that could go in that slot. I have a business. I have employees. You're saying I have to just cast them all to the wind. The interesting thing is in even asking that question, what's being revealed is our fundamental doubt in the inherent goodness of the divine process itself. Because if what we're really being called to do is submit ourselves to something that is the essence of goodness, that is the essence of love and care and really all the best things about our humanity, then wouldn't we assume that surrendering to that and giving ourselves over to that would include that in a sense God would take care of your children? I guess that's maybe the simple way to put it. And I, by the way, Derwin, what you're bringing up is archetypal, and whether it's about our kids or whether it's about our own welfare, in a sense, I think part of what awakens, you know, through this process is a deeper trust. There's a kind of leap of trust, but also there is the awakening of there's a willingness to trust and it becomes a self kind of proving reality, in the sense that when the more one does give oneself to this, be willing to, and I don't mean this in any naive way. I'm not talking about like just accepting everything that happens is supposed to happen for a reason, or, you know, because this kind of spiritual silliness that swirls around out there on a daily basis. Nothing like that. I'm not saying everything happens for a reason. I'm not saying, you know, just accept what comes to your life. What I'm saying more is align yourself with truth, with your own deepest recognition of what is really true here and of what's needed from you and of, you know, in a sense, you know, where, if you were to align wholeheartedly with your spiritual passion, where would it take you? And are you willing to go there? Are you willing to follow your own deepest knowing of what's most important and what's possible and give everything to reach for that with everything you have? And in the trust that giving everything to that is, of course, going to ultimately also include your own welfare. It's going to include the welfare of your children or other obligations you have. It's not going to make you, you know, some brute person who doesn't care about other people, but that you're going to put first things first no matter what, in the trust that will align and prioritize everything else in your life in a way that's appropriate and right. So that's my answer.
Great. Thanks, Craig. So let's take a question. If there's anyone on the line from Europe, just press star 6 to unmute your line. Europe.
Well, I'm not Europe. I was liking to speak earlier. Is it okay? I don't think anyone from Europe is going to talk.
Sure. Go right ahead. What's your name and the city you're from?
This is Sam. I just wanted to say
a few Sam, sorry, which city are you from, Sam?
Hello. Oh, I'm from Michigan.
Michigan. Okay, great. Go right ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say a profound thank you to you guys for really doing this. I mean, I feel more than what I've gotten through you or the teachers is a real, like, confidence in the center of my being that I really am on a journey for myself, whether I'm just working out or whether we call it spiritual or whatever. And it's just incredible. You know, the feeling that I have about this shift is really ineffable. It's beyond words, but it's something that I feel that you, Craig, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name, ma'am. I apologize.
Claire.
Thank you. And you both have done a really wonderful job in just helping to facilitate this in all of us rather than, like, telling us this is what you should do and follow that, allowing us to find that within us. And I think that's a really cool way to go about it. And I really appreciate you for putting on the series and getting this out into the world. You know, cool.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Sam. To remute your line.
Appreciate it, man.
So, Craig, we have another question coming through here on the webcast from Julia Sadi Kauna in WI. There's a lot of emphasis on the discovery of a unique purpose or identity with a unique self and unique gifts, implying that we can know who we are, where we're going, what we're supposed to do. Is the call to an ultimate purpose really ever knowable? What if any purpose seems like the biggest mystery of all? Quite sure there at the end, but I think you get the essence of Julia's question.
I do, and I actually really appreciate the question because I think this is an area that there is a lot of confusion around this right now in the contemporary spiritual kind of subculture that we find ourselves in. And what I want to say first about it is that I think the impulse to find, like, my unique life's purpose, even though it may sound very egocentric and kind of small relative to what I was just speaking about in terms of a kind of ultimate purpose, I think it's part of a wholesome impulse to try to find meaning and purpose, because I think we live in a world that, you know, after several hundred years of modernism, of scientism, you know, taking up so much space in the public dialogue, you know, we've been fed a sort of narrative that says that there really isn't any meaning and purpose to life. And so I think people are yearning for a sense of meaning and purpose and trying to find it in whatever way I think is a noble thing. But what I do want to say is that the truth is that most of us And I know I'll get to your actual question in a little. I'm just trying to come at it a little different way to create some context for my answer. But I think the thing is that the thing about finding your personal purpose is the question is the purpose of which part of yourself. Because, you see, if you're still living your life fundamentally within the structures of your personal conditioned ego, it's not going to be possible to really even see what your kind of higher potentials and purpose might be. I mean, if you go and do a big workshop on finding your life's purpose or your unique life's soul purpose, whatever it might be, and then you come out of that, you do visualizations and you do, you know, visioning and opening, and you come out of that with this picture. I know my purpose is I'm going to do, you know, whatever. I don't want to say anything specific because anything could be a great thing to spend your time on, but you come out of it with some very specific picture. Well, now, what I would say to you is I would imagine that if you maybe instead of doing that, engaged in really applied, you know, for several years of deep spiritual practice and work to remove all of the obstacles to your genuine awakening In other words, did the real work of deconstructing the ego in all of its manifestations and of really awakening to this higher, deeper impulse that's running through the cosmos, and allowed that to become the center of your life. That if you then ask the question, what's my life purpose, you'd probably find a very different answer than the one you got prior to all that work. And that's because your values would have changed, your motives would have changed, how you see what you believe to be real and important would have changed. And so the whole notion that we all sort of have a life's purpose and we just need to find what it is really, it's sort of asking the wrong question, I would say. I think the real question that, and I think this will bring back into your question here, is that in a sense, it's not that everybody in the world has the same ultimate purpose, because really what I'm speaking about here, this wouldn't apply to everybody. Like this call that I'm putting forward to align yourself with the impulse of evolution and live for a greater purpose and be a manifestation of the divine cosmic force on Earth and help create heaven on Earth. I mean, how many people on Earth does that really apply to? Does it apply to the person who has to spend their entire day, you know, out begging for food on the streets of Bombay, or to the person who has to work, you know, toil in a field somewhere at some factory farm in Africa, you know, for some large corporation just to scrape enough money to get through, you know, the day, feed their family? I mean, the people who are in survival consciousness, will not ever have the freedom and the luxury to ask these questions, nor should we expect that of them. I think our goal should be to help lift more and more people out of survivalist consciousness so they have the freedom to contemplate higher things. I mean, we're all part of an evolutionary trajectory, and we really want to care for that whole process. But the truth, what I'm talking about, is for those of us who, and really everything I'm saying here came from, you know, really I learned all of this in some sense from my own teacher, Andrew Cohen. I mean, he has made this beautiful point that those of us who have the luxury to think about these things, to be in this kind of a contemplation and a discussion, that we have an inherent obligation to the rest of humanity. We have an obligation to everybody who came before us and worked so hard to create this luxury that we now enjoy. We have an obligation to the whole thing to live our lives for a greater purpose. And that is something that's universal in the sense for those of us in the position that we are in and who are at the level of development that we find ourselves at. And I would say, you know, within that, sure, we all can find our unique place, our unique role, our unique gifts will come forward that will allow us to serve. You know, we're all going to serve the great cause of our time in different ways. And that's a beautiful thing, and all of that individuality is a wonderful thing. But I would say, don't ask yourself really what your purpose is as much as try to get in touch with the heartbeat of creation and allow that to guide your life.
Wonderful, thank you. I think we have time for one more question. Is there anyone from any other part of the world who would like to ask a question live? Hello.
Hi, this is Ted from Boston.
Okay, go right ahead.
Thank you. Craig, I really enjoyed you sharing about your own personal journey and as you went through this whole spiritual path of yours. And I guess my question is, if we don't have the inner subjective structure to take on this new evolutionary and integral perspective, is it better to look for that within the context of the existing theistic or even, you know, non-theistic traditions and try to transform them from within? Or is it better to start something new, a new religion, a new community? I know Ken Wilber talks about this idea of the conveyor belt, you know, and as far as trying to transform the current traditions. Andrew even talks about, in a sense of coming up with a new bodhisattva vow, you know, which would probably be something that could happen in a non-theistic tradition. And I'm just wondering, what's your view on this?
Beautiful question. That's a really great question. Could I just get everybody to remute their lines? You can leave yours unmuted in case you want to do any back and forth, but just other folks, because I can hear some noise starting to show up. So here's, I guess, what I would say. I mean, I would say it probably depends on you and your predilections and really your kind of alliances. Because, see, in a sense, I think we probably, in the grand scheme of things, we need people to do both of the things you mentioned. And I would say so for yourself. So if you're somebody who really has strong ties to a particular tradition, and you, let's say you just love Christianity, and you feel in that the mythology of that, and I don't mean mythology in any pejorative sense. You know, we all have mythologies, but the mythology of that really appeals to you, really still speaks to you, really lights your spiritual heart on fire, and you feel moved when you look at your fellow parishioners, and you say, you know, this whole Christian movement, we need to reinvigorate it with a new integral evolutionary context. We need to bring it into the 21st century, and we need to really make it true to, like, who would Jesus have been if he was alive now, and what would he be excited about now, and then try to, like, you know, embody those principles but in a truly contemporary context that's really pioneering and you know, is itself a new revelation in a sense from authentic spiritual practice within that context, but informed by, you know, evolutionary and integral, you know, vision, then I would say go do that, because that obviously needs to happen. You know, there are so many people in the contained within the traditions, and those provide structure, and we need structure. So yes, you know, go for that if that's what really moves you. But if, on the other hand, you're somebody who says, you know, even though I maybe grew up in this tradition and I have a lot of friends there, and, you know, I still sometimes go to church, but you're not, or synagogue or the mosque or whatever it is, but I'm not really, you know, I feel like it's all kind of old. I feel like all the mythology is kind of old. Why do we really need to look back thousands of years? And can't we just, you know, give birth to an authentic post-traditional, postmodern, post-postmodern, post-traditional, post-metaphysical, whatever, wisdom tradition that really is just, you know, our own discovery and revelation today of the highest truths, you know, of the past, because they're all still alive now, and they're all still reachable by anybody who's willing to do the serious spiritual work to discover them, you know, and let's together, you know, going and find a kindred spirits that you want to do something with, then by all means, I would say go create your own, you know, start together, or maybe you find another community of people that are doing it, or, you know, if you live in the Bay Area, you know, maybe you'll connect. There's a group of us starting to build some community around this here, and maybe we'll connect, and, you know, whatever. I think we kind of need all of it to happen. So did that touch on all of it? Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot. I can take one more, because I heard there was somebody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Carolyn,
go right ahead.
Great talk. I was wondering if you could give a short kind of visual about what a typical day would be for someone who's reached this sort of level of enlightenment. If you're like, you know, a regular person with some kind of a regular job, how would your life be different when you got up on Monday morning?
Well, I guess it probably depends on what kind of regular person we're thinking of. Sam, I'm. Hey, Sam. Let me just try to talk to Carolyn, okay? I appreciate your enthusiasm, buddy. I'm just trying to.
If I could just ask, if everyone other than Carolyn could just press *6 to unmute your line, just so we can keep a clear line. Thank you.
Yeah. So, well, because see, the thing is, there are. I think I'm going to dispense with the notion of regular person for one, and let's just say, you know, because I mean, I think people are at all different. People have all kinds of different relationships to their lives, you know. Some regular folks get up every morning and they meditate for 2 hours, and then they go and work out, and then they go to work. Some regular people just roll out of bed and barely make it to work on time. You know, I mean, there's a whole spectrum. So I think maybe – I don't know if this is going to get at what you're trying to get at, but I think if what I hear you saying is, well – Are you looking for the outward expression? Like, not so much what might my inner life be like or what might I be doing inwardly, but are you looking at how am I going to behave differently? Is that it? Caroline, you still there?
I guess that's what it would be. I think that's what I'm asking is, like, how would my life be different if I was at that level of enlightenment?
Well, and I, you know, it's funny because, again, I feel myself saying, well, I don't know enough about your life now to be able to tell you. But I want to obviously get at the essence of it. Because, see, Caroline, the truth is you might be living with such a remarkable and extraordinary degree of integrity already that, you know, some parts of your life wouldn't necessarily change. You know, I think for many people, what happens as they begin to wake up is there's this, they begin to recognize so many ways in which they've acted that are perpetuating ignorance, that are causing suffering for others, that are causing suffering for themselves. They realize, you know, we realize, wow, you know, I'm so, you know, it changes the way you relate in all of your relationships. Maybe you realize I'm so needy, or I'm so dependent, or I'm so forcing my own opinion on everybody else, or I'm so arrogant. I mean, you know, any of the sort of negative human qualities, all of that gets seen and kind of penetrated through as we start to wake up, and we want to shed these qualities and become a kind of luminous expression of all of the best aspects of being human. That it's just we feel compelled to be an example of all the best attributes of what it could be, what it is, and what it could be to be human. It's like there's this burning passion to be the, you know, it's a cliche right now, be the change you want to see in the world, but that becomes like a living, burning kind of passionate reality. And so
it's almost like everything that you touch or interface with in the world now has this new enlightened response to it. Like, so for example, I might not throw my, I might, when I go to get a coffee at Starbucks, I might just say, just give that to me in a porcelain cup and forget the paper cup for a bigger reason.
Well, certainly all of those things, I think should be the byproduct of a more awake relationship to life. But I'm really talking about, maybe this will get at it, and then we'll kind of call it, because I know I've gone over. But here, I think this might get at it for you. The question might be, how would your life change if you took it upon yourself to be the example for all human beings to follow as to what would be the optimal human expression? So, like, for instance, here's another practice you can take up. Imagine that a new, this has been put in place by the sort of world, we have a world government, and they've decided that they want to kind of broadcast for all of humanity what the ideal person looks like and how they live, so that that everybody can see what the most illuminated and enlightened life, evolutionary life, would look like, so we can have some pattern to map on, because we know we're social creatures and we know we tend to map on each other and, you know, follow each other's lead. And they've decided to elected you, and you've been chosen, Caroline, to be the one who's going to be the example for all humanity to follow. And you're going to have a camera following you 24 hours a day throughout your life, and your life is going to be broadcast throughout the entire world, and it's your job to set the tone. So in other words, if you know, let's say one day are a bit emotionally indulgent and reactive in some kind of interaction, that then the whole world's going to act like that, because they think that's how, you know, that enlightened person would be. Or let's say, you know, you start to act with extraordinary courage and generosity and authenticity, the whole world's going to follow suit. So take that out into your day for tomorrow, maybe, and see how that changes the way you would behave. And I think that might at least start to take you in the direction that I'm talking about.
That's brilliant. Thank
how
you
does that
so
sound?
Much,
okay. Right. Hey, beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks,
everyone. It's been really great, and I know we need to wrap up now. So been a pleasure. I wish we could have taken more, and I look forward to continuing the series.
Well, thank you, Craig. This has been an illuminating conversation. If you want to find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton, visit integralenlightenment.com. That's integralenlightenment.com. Before I tell you about what's coming up next week, just a few reminders. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, just be sure to join our Facebook group, where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today. Go to facebook.com and search for Great Integral Awakening, or just click on the link in the email we sent you this morning. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/integralspirit. And if you have any friends you think might be interested in this series, please forward one of our emails to them so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio, or you found it on some far-flung corner of the Internet and would like to listen to the other 14 dialogues in the series, visit greatintegralawakening.com. That's greatintegralawakening.com, where you can register for free and get the audios you've missed and be on the list to get the access codes for the teleseminars that are coming up in the coming weeks. And finally, I want to thank the sponsors who've made all this possible, including Now and Zen, makers of the Zen Alarm Clock, iEvolve, Global Practice Community, The Shift Movie, The New Feminine Power, Ursa Minor Media and Arts, Enlighten Next, Next Step Integral, and Big Mind, and our two co-hosts, Integral Life and Integral Enlightenment. Now about next week's events. Join us next week at the same time for a teleseminar with spiritual teacher Diane Mushu Hamilton entitled Facing the Shadow, An Integral Approach to the Dark Side. Diane Mushu Hamilton is a fully ordained Zen priest and teacher. She is a core founder and faculty member of iEvolve, Global Practice Community, and is the director of the Integral Life Spiritual Center at Integral Life. Diane is a gifted facilitator, mediator, and spiritual teacher, and is well known as an innovator in facilitating group dialogues, especially conversations about culture, religion, race, and gender relations. So we're really looking forward to continuing the conversation and the dialogue with Diane next week. We'll send you an event description and access codes for that event this coming week. Until then, thanks for joining us, and we're just going to unmute all the lines so we can say goodbye.
All callers are unmuted.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great week.
Thanks.